Citizen Soldiers, Disc 10.
Shelling made Foxhole living worse. Mortars and artillery could come in at any time. The Germans would watch the GIs take up a position at the end of a day, mark it on their maps, and shell it at night. Private Arnold Ben Parrish of the 2nd Infantry Division remembered a night during the Bulge when he and a buddy had dug a hole long enough and wide enough to accommodate both men, but only about 8 inches deep. As they worked on it, shelling began. "It was raining shells, and they were exploding all around our hole. The air was full of shrapnel, and spent pieces were hitting us as we laid on our backs with our helmets over our faces. The noise was unbearable, and the ground was shaking, and we were shaking from fright and cold. We didn't dare raise our heads. It would have been impossible to survive outside of the hole." Cries of, "Medic!" Tree limbs hurtling through the air, the smell of powder, the bangs and flashes and booms and screams, red-hot bits of metal zooming through the air. The only movement you could make was to press ever closer to the ground. Those who endured such a cataclysm were forever scarred by it, even if untouched by shrapnel. "We were helpless and all alone, and there was nothing we could do. So I prayed to God. The time went by very slow. I tried to keep warm, but that wasn't possible. I thought about my mother and hoped she didn't know where I was or what I was doing. Maybe this is the end of the world," I thought. Feelings of helplessness were universal. Corporal Stanley Kalberer, a college student at the beginning of 1944, was by December a replacement in the 84th Division. During the Bulge, he, too, got caught in a shelling and described his experience. "I never felt so alone, frightened, forgotten, abused, and degraded. I truly believed I would never survive, or, if I did, I would be maimed by the weather or killed by the enemy, or both." Private Vonnegut described a shelling during the Bulge with a novelist's insight. "The incredible artificial weather that Earthlings sometimes create for other Earthlings when they don't want those other Earthlings to inhabit Earth anymore. Shells bursting in the treetops with terrific bangs, showering down knives and needles and razor blades. Little lumps of lead in copper jackets were crisscrossing the woods under the shell bursts, zipping along much faster than sound." During a January shelling, Lieutenant Ott's platoon was on the verge of breakdown. During a lull, some men were crying, others telling Ott's they couldn't stand anymore. Ott's told them of the system he and his Foxhole buddies used to keep from going crazy. "We pretended that the company area was a target, as on a rifle range, and that our Foxhole was the center, or bullseye. We would lie in our hole and score the Heinies on their artillery rounds according to how close they came to our hole. 5 for a bullseye, and 4, 3, 2, and 1 as they landed farther away. We gave them a Maggie's drawers, as the red flag on a rifle range is called, for a complete miss." Decades later, Ott's commented, "This helped pass the time, but I could think of things I would rather do." Every man in a foxhole, especially during a shelling, could think of things he would rather do. It seemed it would last forever. It seemed you couldn't possibly survive. In contrast to the ordeal of shelling, there were endless hours in which nothing happened. But as Sergeant Fred Clayson of the 78th Infantry Division described his experience in the Bulge, "Holding the line didn't mean just sitting in foxholes waiting for something to happen. It meant a continual battle against trench foot and mental depression, sweating out artillery barrages which the enemy habitually sent in at chow time, and nights which were lighted with flares and flashes, fighting off enemy patrols. But most of all, it meant hours and days of deadly boredom. Men talked softly to relieve the boredom and the tension. Sergeant Robert Rader and Private Don Hubler of the 101st Airborne came from the same town on the banks of the Ohio River. Don and I would talk all night about home, our families, people and places, and what the hell we were doing in a predicament like this, Rader said. Private Ralph Spina of the same company recalled discussing with his foxhole mate, "Politics, the world's problems, plus our own. Wishing we had a drink or a hot meal, preferably in that order. We talked about what we were going to do when we got home, about a trip to Paris, go to the Follies. Mainly, we talked about going home." "I never observed any loners on the front lines," Sergeant Egger said. "The men automatically paired up. The buddy system worked very well. It provided additional security. It provided additional warmth. We were a team, and sharing the adversities of the elements and combat brought us together and created a bond." Foxhole buddies developed a closeness unknown to all others. They were closer than friends, closer than brothers. Their relationship was different from that of lovers. Their trust in and knowledge of each other was total. They got to know each other's life stories, what they did before they came into the Army, what their parents, brothers, and sisters were like, their teachers, what they liked to eat and drink, what their capabilities were. Sometimes they hated one another. More often, they loved one another, in a way known only to combat veterans. Without thinking about it, they would share their last bite or last drink of water or a blanket, and they would die for one another. They also complained constantly about the other guy's habits, physical and mental, his farts, his cough, the songs he hummed, his size, his intelligence or lack thereof, his politics, his nationality, his Confederate or Yankee sympathies, his taste in books or comics. Private Keith Lance of the 84th Division was that rare creature, an atheist in a foxhole. His buddy was a good Catholic boy from upstate New York. They were being shelled, and the buddy "Hailed Mary all night. After taking so many hours of that," Lance commented, "he had had enough, so he dashed out of the foxhole to check on the guys. As he threw himself into the next hole, Lance heard an explosion. He looked aghast. It had hit his old hole. His buddy was badly wounded and buried in mud. They were young men with high testosterone levels. As combat infantrymen, they were not having sex for weeks, sometimes months. But homosexual activity in the foxholes was rare to non-existent. Beyond the danger inherent in forgetting where you were, the U.S. Army in World War II was brutal in its punishment of known homosexuals. They were stripped of all insignia, drummed out of the service, given long sentences in the stockade, disgraced without mercy. They were also beaten up by their fellow soldiers, who were strongly homophobic. Instead of acting out their sexual needs, the men in the foxholes talked about girls and dreamed about them. One night, outside Bastogne, Private Al Vittori and Private Ed Babe Heffron of the 101st Airborne managed to catch some sleep. Heffron woke when Vittori threw his heavy leg over his body. When Vittori started to rub Heffron's chest, Heffron gave him a shot with his elbow in the belly. Vittori woke and demanded to know what the hell was going on. Heffron started to give him hell in return. Vittori grinned and said he had been dreaming about his wife. "Al," Heffron said, "I can't help you, as I got combat boots, jump pants, and my trench coat on, and they are not coming off." Private Kurt Gable of the 17th Airborne dealt with the sexual deprivation problem by talking to his foxhole buddy Jake as if they were a married couple. On one of their first nights together, following a shelling at the chow line, Jake commented indignantly, "This is no way for civilized human beings to dine." They lay down in their hole and tried to get comfortable. Gable turned, jabbing Jake with his elbow. Jake jabbed back and issued a warning. "And another thing, dearie, if you thrash around like this habitually, you'll simply have to sleep in the guest room." "Calm down, dear," Gable replied. "We'll be moving out of here before long, and I just know you'll find us a much nicer and larger place. Now let's kiss and make up, and I'll take you to a fantastic little place for dinner." Sitting in frontline foxholes was bad. Being on OP was worse. Going on combat patrol at night was worse than that. Battalion commanders on both sides ordered patrols, sometimes to take prisoners for interrogation, often just to give the men something to do. Such patrols proved that the battalion commander was aggressive. Company commanders and platoon leaders, not to mention the men, hated night patrols. Lieutenant Ott's had his own method of complying with such orders. "I would send a couple of men out to see if the Heinies were still there, telling them to take a look and come right back without drawing any fire. I believed in letting well enough alone. We could have gone over, tossed a few grenades, and fired a few shots into their holes, but they would only have come back and done the same thing to us, with nothing gained by either side. I liked everything as it was, nice and peaceful, and couldn't see the sense in stirring up a hive full of sleeping bees. The battalion CO might have known best, but he was several thousand yards from the enemy, while we were only 50. Sometimes on night patrol, young Germans passed by young Americans within touching distance. Despite the adrenaline rush, most often each side waited to see what the other would do, which usually was nothing. On at least some occasions, 18-year-old GIs and Germans smiled at each other as they passed. Lieutenants Harold Linebaugh and John Campbell of the 84th Division were out one night during the bulge, feeling their way through the dark, forcing their way through the drifts, stopping frequently to listen for sounds of nearby troops. "We paused," Campbell remembered, "and heard a rustling noise, very close. We dropped to a crouch alongside a narrow trail. A dozen men passed by, taking care to make as little noise as possible." "They were Germans," Campbell said, "and they weren't lost. They passed so close we could have reached out and tripped each man as he hurried by." Private Gus Schroeder of Wisconsin grew up speaking German. He was in the 90th Division. A buddy described him as a big man, incredibly strong, and almost a child otherwise. One night on patrol, Schroeder fell in with a German patrol and spoke to them in fluent German. He was brave to the point of being foolhardy. But he personally captured 100 German soldiers. Lieutenant Colby of the 90th went out on a night patrol in Normandy to keep an eye on a new squad leader. Colby was in the middle of a string of 7 men following a railroad track. The private in front of him began crawling. Colby asked him why he was crawling. "Everyone ahead of me is crawling." They crawled on for 50 meters. Colby bumped into the man in front of him. "Now what's up?" "I bumped into the man ahead of me." After another advance, the patrol stopped. "Why have we stopped?" Colby whispered. "I sent our scout on ahead," the squad leader replied. After an hour, the scout returned. "Can you see anything?" Colby asked. "Shit, I think I've seen my whole life pass in front of me," the breathless scout exclaimed. "I have seen every damned thing imaginable out there. I have seen tanks and battleships coming down these tracks right at me." Later, Colby was promoted to captain and took command of the company. One night in the Bulge, he went into a wooded area to check on his overextended outpost line. He bumped into a two-man German patrol. Colby dropped his carbine and put up his hands. The Germans dropped their rifles and put up their hands. The three men talked in broken English and fractured German. The Germans persuaded Colby that as they had him outnumbered, he would have to take them in. They became POWs. Their war was over. Colby's went on. Much of the time, it was pitch black during the Belgian night. Private Jean Amisi of the 84th recalled the blackest night of all. "It was raining. No stars, no moon, no nothing. And not knowing where you're going. Everybody hanging on to the guy in front, hanging on to his belt, and just walking. You just kept walking. All you see was a head up there in front of you." At Hagenau, Germany, in February 1945, Major Winters of the 101st sent out a patrol that succeeded in bringing back a couple of prisoners. His CO, Colonel Robert Sink, was so delighted that he ordered another one for the next night. But that day, it snowed, then turned colder. The snow was frozen on top, crunchy, noisy. The cold air had cleared the sky, and the moon was shining. Winters thought a patrol under the circumstances was suicidal, so he decided to disobey orders. Sink and a couple of his staff officers came to Winters' CP to observe. They had a bottle of whiskey with them. Winters said he was going to the line to supervise the patrol. When he got to the foxholes, he told the men to just stay still. With the whiskey working on him, Sink would soon be ready for bed. The patrol could report in the morning that it had penetrated the German lines, but had been unable to get a live prisoner. There wasn't anything the colonel could do about it. How do you intimidate a combat infantryman? As every GI and ETO understood, the stockade was infinitely safer than a foxhole on the front line, and far more comfortable. Being attacked by a German force at night was the worst experience. On the night of December 27th, Sergeant Dwayne Burns of the 82nd Airborne had it. He was on outpost duty when, at 0115, the Germans attacked. A machine gun crew to his right put a string of tracers into a haystack 100 meters in front of the line. As it flared up, "All we could see were Germans. They were down on their bellies, crawling toward our lines." "Good Lord," I said. "How did they get there so fast? Another minute and they would have been crawling up into our holes with us." The forward observer called in artillery. The men in their holes started shooting. "I didn't see how anyone could live through it, but the Germans were still coming. They just kept coming right into our fire. Some of them reached the ditch on the other side of the line. It looked like they would overrun our position just by the sheer strength of numbers." The observer called for American fire right on top of the line. "I had seen a lot of incoming artillery fire," Burns said, "but nothing like this. It was turning night into day. It was fantastic. I wanted to watch, but I also wanted to be at the bottom of my hole." The German attackers fell back. The artillery fire died down. Burns got a call on the radio. It was the company CP. The phone line had been cut by a shell. A man had gone out from the CP to find the break and repair it, but he had not come back. Someone had to do the job. "The someone they were talking about was me," Burns remarked. "Funny how when there is a dangerous job to do, they don't call names. Just someone had to do it." Burns slipped out of his hole and started back, holding the wire in one hand and his M1 in the other. "I took off on a dead run, doubled over to keep low, trying to make a very small target. As I ran, ice and snow from the wire would build up in my hand. I would have to stop, shake it off, and then start out again. 100 yards out, I found the break in the wire. I also found the man from the CP. He had found the break, but had been killed before he could make the splice. I stripped off my gloves, dropped down to one knee, and went to work, while watching out for Germans at the same time. We had heard about how the Germans would cut our wire, wait for someone to come out to fix it, and then take them prisoner. I tied and taped the wire in record time and ran for my hole. I didn't even slow down when I got there. I just went in head first. In the morning, we started a count of the dead. We had only one man killed and a few wounded. We could see enemy dead everywhere, some within 20 feet of our line. We counted more than 100 dead Germans. When men got out of the holes, they looked like slaves coming up from a coal mine shaft. In February 1945, Company C of the 395th Regiment was relieved in position by the 69th Division after living in holes in the ground for almost 3 months. When we popped out of the ground, some of the green 69th Division troops passing by were convinced that they were relieving an all-black infantry battalion. God-awful though the conditions were, men endured and prevailed. How they did so differed with each individual, but all had a sense of fatalism. Private Ken Webster of the 101st Airborne expressed his feelings and insights in a letter to his mother. "I am living on borrowed time. If I don't come back, try not to take it too hard. I wish I could persuade you to regard death as casually as we do over here. In the heat of battle, you expect casualties. You expect somebody to be killed, and you're not surprised when a friend is machine-gunned in the face. You have to keep going. It's not like civilian life, where sudden death is so unexpected." "There was no time to mourn the dead," Captain Colby remarked, "even if they were good friends." When his mother wrote to express her considerable alarm at this attitude, Webster replied, "Would you prefer for somebody else's son to die in the mud? Somebody has to get in and kill the enemy. Somebody has to be in the infantry and the paratroops. If the country all had your attitude, nobody would fight. Everybody would be in the quartermaster. And what kind of a country would that be?" Carwood Lipton was a sergeant in the 101st Airborne on D-Day, a lieutenant with a battlefield commission during the Bulge. By the end of the war, he had been involved in many different kinds of combat. Asked to comment on how he managed to cope with the challenges of combat, and insofar as he felt he could speak for others in his answer, Lipton said, "When men are in combat, the inevitability of it takes over. They are there. There is nothing they can do to change that. So they accept it. They immediately become callous to the smell of death, the bodies, the destruction, the killing, the danger. Enemy bodies and wounded don't affect them. Their own wounded and the bodies of their dead friends make only a brief impression, and in that impression is a fleeting feeling of triumph or accomplishment that it was not them. There is still work to be done, a war to be won, and they think about that." According to Lipton, it is only later, when a man got off the front line, that he had time to think about how buddies were killed or wounded, or about the times when he personally was inches from death. Out of the line, far from combat, "Death and destruction are no longer inevitable. The war might end. The missions might be canceled." Such thoughts made men nervous about going back into the line. But Lipton insisted, once back in it, all doubts and nervousness disappear. The callousness, the cold-bloodedness, the calmness return. 50 years later, I remarked to Lipton that in December 1944, the stockade was preferable to a foxhole. He turned on me and snapped, "Come on, Steve. No man would choose disgrace. If the stockade was preferable, the stockades would have been full, the foxholes empty, and we would have lost the war." Just there is the point. In the face of conditions scarcely equaled anywhere for fear, degradation, and misery, the great majority of frontline soldiers in ETO in 1944 through 45 stayed in the line and did their duty, and prevailed. There are no unwounded foxhole veterans. Sergeant Ed Stewart of the 84th Division commented decades after the war that he had never known a combat soldier who did not show a residue of war. Stewart's mother told him that he left Europe but never arrived home. Sergeant George Thompson said that when he came home, the sounds of war came with him. Decades later, when I'm home by myself at nighttime, it all comes back. I'll hear the noise, the shells exploding. I stay awake thinking about it. I guess it comes from being in a foxhole, the long hours of nighttime. Chapter 11. Replacements and Reinforcements. Fall, 1944. Frontline divisions in the protracted wars of the 19th and 20th centuries were sooner or later decimated. They were still carried on the roster as divisions when they were no more than two or three companies strong. In World War II, the German and British armies withdrew their divisions after they had suffered severe losses for rest, reinforcements, and reorganization. The U.S. and Red Armies kept their divisions, once committed to combat, in the line for the entire war. They were replenished by a steady stream of replacements, to the point that the majority of fighting men in their armies in the campaigns of 1944 through 45 were individual replacements. Divisions that were in contact with the enemy from Normandy until they reached the German border were well over 100% replacements by December, and four, the 1st, 3rd, 4th, and 29th, were over 200% by the end of the war, and seven others were over 180%. The 90th Division, for example, had more than 35,000 replacements during the course of the campaign, the functional equivalent of three full-strength divisions. General Marshall made the decision to keep American divisions at full strength through regular infusions of replacements, brought forward not in company or even squad strength, but as individuals. That system seemed to hold great promise. American divisions would be able to stay in the line continuously, as they would be drawing in fresh men daily. The replacements would join veteran squads, platoons, companies. They could be integrated into the unit and taught the tricks of survival in combat by old-timers. They would be young, fit, eager, and well-trained. The Normandy battle, however, caused far higher casualties than had been anticipated. From late July on, ETO was short of men, especially riflemen. It would get worse. The 29th suffered 400% casualties in its rifle companies. The Army scrambled to make up ETO's 300,000-man shortfall in fighting men. Eisenhower put cooks, drivers, mechanics, clerks, and other rear echelon personnel into the replacement pipeline for the infantry companies. But it was the home front that had to provide the bulk of the reinforcements. Marshall speeded up training time for youngsters still in the States. He also greatly expanded the immediately available pool by ending the Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP. The ASTP was a pet of Secretary of War Henry Stimson. The idea was to take 150,000 of the brightest draftees and offer to put them through college if they opted for the Army. The Navy had a smaller but similar program already in place. Stimson wanted to compete. Those given the offer were young men whose test scores indicated they would get cushy rear echelon jobs with rapid promotions, or be sent to officer candidate school. Those who accepted had to forego those opportunities. While they were in ASTP, they would remain privates. But the Army would provide their room, board, and tuition, and pay them at a private's rate, $50 per month. They would take regular classes at the colleges and universities, majoring in areas where the Army anticipated specialists would be needed later in the war, such as mathematics, engineering, or foreign languages. Naturally, these whiz kids were much resented. A popular saying with ordinary infantry had it that ASTP stood for All Safe Till Peace. Most ASTPers got started on their education in the fall semester of 1943. By the summer semester of 1944, most were gone. In February 1944, in anticipation of manpower needs after the battle became joined, Marshall cut the program from 150,000 to 30,000. Simultaneously, General Arnold decided that with air superiority won over Europe, the Air Force wasn't going to need anywhere near as many pilots as it had thought. He released 71,000 aviation cadets for the ground forces. The would-be pilots dubbed themselves Grounded Butterflies. So suddenly, there were 190,000 of the best and brightest of the Army's inductees from 1942 through 43, enough for more than 10 divisions available for assignment. What an asset, at a time when every other combatant was taking conscripts too old, too young, too ill to fight. The U.S. Army was feeding into its fighting force its best young men. More than half the ASTPers got sent into rifle companies as replacements. The Army had promised them a free education, then changed its mind and put them into the front lines, where most of them would never have ended up if they had declined the offer to enter the program. There was some bitterness and much bitching, then off to a brief basic training course. When Private Robert Curtis arrived at Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, fresh from Hope College, he joined other ex-ASTPers in a large room. An officer gave a welcome speech. "With your ability and background," he said, "you are something special, and we are therefore going to give you a choice." As we moved to the assignment table, the officer looked up at you and inquired, "What will it be, rifle, machine gun, or mortar?" In training camp, they merged with another stream of replacements on the way to Europe. The ordinary American kids who turned 18 years of age in 1944 and who either volunteered so they could select a service or waited to get drafted. Working class kids, the kind many ASTPers would never have met in civilian life. But the two often hit it off immediately. Kurt Vonnegut had been an ASTPer at Cornell University before joining the 106th Division. He was in a rifle squad. "And those guys were the best guys I ever met." Roughly half the reinforcements flowed from the States to France, usually Le Havre, organized as divisions such as the 99th and the 106th. The remainder of the men were not organized at all. They were simply privates on their way into the battle wherever they were needed. They would be assigned as individuals to companies in the line. They were called replacements. About half the 3 million-plus men who served in the U.S. Army in ETO came onto the continent as replacements. A disproportionate number of them went straight to the rifle companies. Tens of thousands of others came as members of quickly put-together high-number infantry divisions composed of units drawn from all over that had not trained together. At the time of the Bulge, possibly more than 4 out of every 5 infantrymen up front were replacements or men who were members of inadequately trained divisions that were new to combat. How those reinforcements got from their basic training to a foxhole was the responsibility of the replacement system. The colonels on the staff felt their first responsibility was to the needs of the front, which they decided meant keeping the flow going at maximum speed without regard for what was going into the flow. When a ship arrived at Le Havre, a replacement went directly to a reception depot, a tent city where he knew no one, then on to a stockage depot where he received a rifle, lectures in hygiene, and, if lucky, some desperately needed additional training. Some of the replacements had never even held an M1 or qualified with any weapon. Lieutenant George Wilson, CO of a rifle company deeply involved in the Bulge, received 100 replacements on December 29th. "We discovered that these men had been on the rifle range only once. They had never thrown a grenade or fired a bazooka, mortar, or machine gun." After 2 days to a week at the stockage, the replacement went to the 3rd Replacement Depot, or Repel-Depel, which supported the 1st Army, and later to a forward battalion supporting a corps. Finally, he was brought forward to a company CP and led out to a foxhole. He did not know the name of anyone around him. "Being a replacement is just like being an orphan," one soldier told an Army survey team. "You are away from anybody you know and feel lost and lonesome." Private Morris Dunn, who ended up with the 84th Division, spent weeks in a Repel-Depel. "We were just numbers. We didn't know anybody, and I've never felt so alone and miserable and helpless in my entire life. We'd been herded around like cattle at roundup time. On the ride to the front, it was cold and raining, with the artillery fire louder every mile, and finally we were dumped out in the middle of a heavily damaged town." That was how most of the replacements got to the most dangerous place in the world. Unknown, unknowing, scared, bewildered, untrained. According to Captain Roland, "Only a Kafka could truly describe the depersonalizing effects of the replacement system." Every one of nearly a million men who went through it agreed. Had the Germans been given a free hand to devise a replacement system for ETO, one that would do the Americans the most harm and least good, they could not have done a better job. The Repel-Depel was universally despised and denounced. "When the war is over," one replacement said to another, "I'm going to attend the war crimes trial of the men responsible for this system. I want to watch them shoot the bastards." Yet the system had been based on some solid thinking and past experience and, of course, good intentions. It failed because of unexpected but predictable consequences. The Army knew it had problems and did some studies. These led to inconsequential reforms, such as putting recreational facilities into the Repel-Depels and changing the designation from replacement to reinforcement for its perceived psychological benefit. One suggestion was on the mark. It was to put the replacements in squads that would stay together from basic training to the foxholes. That would have helped. To have put them into companies would have been even more effective in creating that bond that is critical to combat infantry. Best would have been as battalions, ready to relieve combat-weary units at the front. Better than nothing at all would have been orientation lectures on life at the front, taught by wounded veterans. These suggestions were not acted on. The Repel-Depel system stayed. At the end of the war in Europe, men were still assigned as individuals to combat units. In this, the Army failed to look after its own. The replacements paid the cost. Often more than half became casualties within the first 3 days on the line. The odds were against a replacement surviving long enough to gain recognition and experience. They came in, according to Private Ken Russell of the 82nd Airborne, "all good boys with the strength of a mule and the ignorance of old maids. We pitied the scared, shy, eager youngsters who were awestruck around us old boys." Russell was 19. In the first battle, they usually died in heaps. It was to the obvious benefit of the old boys to help the new kids, but nevertheless, most veterans tried to avoid replacements. For one thing, the new men tended to draw fire because they bunched up. Ken Russell commented that veterans died separately and not in bunches as replacements often did. Talked too much or lit cigarettes at night. For another, men just didn't want to make friends with guys whom they expected to die soon. Veterans resented replacements for one overwhelming reason. When replacements came, it meant the division was staying in the line or attacking. So most of his first days on the line, the recruit remained alone. If a replacement did get some attention from the veterans, it didn't help his morale. As one old-timer said, "When you bring in a bunch of recruits, the talk gets louder and more boisterous to make an impression." Private Clayton Shepherd found himself with Company K, 332nd Infantry, 84th Division. As he got to the platoon, a patrol came in. They said, "This man got his head blowed off, this man his arm blowed off, and all that." And I thought, "Jesus Christ, what am I getting into here? They shouldn't have told us new guys that. They scared the hell out of me before I even got started." Veterans in the 90th Division, themselves replacements just a few days or weeks earlier, told newcomers not to worry about getting killed. "Death can't be all that bad," they pointed out. "No one ever heard a dead man complain." In February 1945, Captain Douglas Smith, 94th Division, gathered a bunch of replacements in a cellar just behind the front lines. He wanted to instill some confidence, so he told them they were joining the finest combat outfit in the whole damned army. After, he asked his sergeant, Jim Morrison, "Did I make sense, or did I sound like I was full of shit?" "You sounded sincere enough," Morrison replied. "But they know the only reason they're here is because someone else got hit or killed. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here." Replacements usually came up in small groups. They clung to one another because other recruits were the only ones in the entire U.S. Army with whom they had anything in common. Their first day, they bunched up physically on the front. If they survived the almost certain shelling, they learned not to. Dutch Schultz remembered a time in the Bulge when five replacements were killed by one shell before they were even assigned to any of the platoons. In the Repeldepel, the soldiers were merely numbers, with no choice as to where they were going to go. Except once, when Captain James Eichner of the Rangers showed up. The Bulge was on, and the Rangers had been decimated in the Hurtgen Forest. Eichner was there to pick some recruits. "The Rangers select the people that they want," he explained, "and they have to measure up. They have to be outstanding young men, above average in physical and mental stamina, and we took in no low IQ cases." Eichner got a few thousand men together in the auditorium at the Repeldepel. He told them, quite frankly, who we were and what we were, that we would do our best to give them whatever training we could, sort of an on-the-job training, and that when we left, we would go directly to the front line and combat. He asked for volunteers and got hundreds. He selected 53, who seemed to measure up. He took them by truck back to the Bulge. Just as we were dumping them out, why, here comes an enemy artillery barrage, and these poor guys, new to combat, the first shell fire they had heard, scattered in all directions. It took us a while to get them all rounded up, Two or three were killed and many wounded. Replacements exposed themselves senselessly. Private Robert Curtis of the 76th Division remembered his first day on the line. His mortar crew moved to a bluff hanging over a river. "Since everything seemed quiet on the other side of the river," Curtis said, "I stood up to get a better look. There was an almost instant explosion. A mortar shell went off a few yards away."
"Jesus Christ, get down!" the sergeant screamed. "I've got a wife and kids at home."
In early January, Sergeant Lick of the 1st Division received 5 replacements for his platoon. One was from the Air Force ground crew, one from the quartermaster, one a mechanic, and 2 fresh from basic training. The Air Force man got a fever and was sent back. So too for the quartermaster. The mechanic became a machine gunner and survived. As for the 2 replacements from the States, they volunteered to go back to Battalion HQ for rations, and on the way, both got hit by a shell, killing one and wounding the other. They didn't even get their names on our platoon roster. Private Jim Graff of the 35th Division was a 19-year-old replacement who went into the line at night and never saw his foxhole companion until first light. A month later, he was a veteran. His squad leader saw some replacements being dumped in the middle of a village. He told Graff to pick out an assistant BAR man for himself. "I went out in the streets, and this one individual looked lost," Graff recalled. "I asked if he knew anything about a BAR. "Hell no," the replacement replied. "I don't know anything, not even about this rifle they just gave me." It was an M1. Graff figured everyone in the Army had qualified on an M1 and was astonished. The replacement explained that he had been a mechanic in the artillery for years. He had taken his basic in 1941 when the Army was still using the 1903 Springfield bolt-action rifle. Graff took him anyway. War is full of surprises. On at least one occasion, the greenness of a replacement officer paid big dividends. During the bulge, Company Commander John Colby told a platoon leader fresh from the States to capture a house. He walked up to it and knocked on the door. Jesus! I had not given him instructions on how to take a house on the outskirts of a village. Instead of heaving a grenade and having his men kick in the door and rush in firing away, he was standing there waiting for someone to open it. A German sergeant in his undershirt, suspenders hanging down, answered the knock. The replacement lieutenant said something to him. The German came outside and yelled. Several other Germans rose up from positions behind a fence and barn and put their hands in the air. The sergeant sent a runner to his machine gun crew with orders to come in and give up. The entire group, American and German, moved into the village. At each house, the German sergeant called on more of his men to give up. Germans and Americans alike were wearing white sheets. They milled together in the village square. Americans frisked Germans for watches, pistols, and binoculars. And the astonished Colby noted, "Some Germans were doing the same to my men." German sergeants abhorred disorder. This one barked out orders in English and in German. He ordered Colby's men to line up on one side of the road, the Germans on the other. He called them all to attention. Then he formally surrendered his company to Colby. Colby commented, "Had our new green, inexperienced officer taken that first house properly, as I intended, all kinds of shooting would have broken out with lots of casualties. As it was, no one got hurt, and we took about 100 prisoners. That's the way to fight a war." It was bad enough being an untrained infantry replacement. It could be worse, going into armor untrained. Yet many did. One tank commander remembered that in the bulge, "I spent long hours in the turret when I was literally showing men how to feed bullets to the gun. Could they shoot straight? They couldn't even hold the gun right. In the midst of the toughest fighting of the Third Army's campaign, I was teaching men what I had learned in basic training. Sergeant Raymond Janis of the 1st Infantry Division got a new 3-man crew for his light tank. They were all 18 years of age. Only one had driven a car, and that only to church on Sundays. He became driver. Neither of the other two had any experience firing a machine gun or a 37-millimeter tank gun. Janis gave them a 2-hour demonstration. Then he moved out on a mission. The tank had hardly proceeded a half kilometer when the driver panicked and rolled the tank down a hill. The crash threw Janis out of the turret and on his head, causing a severe concussion that cost him his hearing. The replacements paid the price for a criminally wasteful replacement system that chose to put quantity ahead of quality. Its criteria was the flow of bodies. Whose fault was this? Eisenhower's first. He was the boss. And Bradley's. And Patton's. They demanded an ever greater flow of replacements while doing precious little to insist on improving the training, and got what they demanded. In no other way did the American High Command in ETO show such disengagement as Eisenhower, Bradley, et al. Did in failing to look at the source of their replacements, and then to force some obvious and relatively easy improvements in the REPL-DEPLs and in the assignment methods. It can only be that Eisenhower, Bradley, et al. Had no clear conception of life on the front line. They didn't listen to foxhole GIs often enough. So they threw the 18-year-olds and the former ASTPers into the battle, untrained, alone. The American Army, approaching Germany in the fall of 1944, was, in part, a children's crusade. It had hundreds of thousands of 18- to 20-year-old soldiers, most of them at the cutting edge of the general offensive, and almost none of them properly trained for combat. Captain Roland remembered receiving replacements in January, a number of whom had eaten Christmas dinner at home with their families, who were killed in action before they had an opportunity to learn the names of the soldiers in the foxholes with them. As noted, Eisenhower said that in war everything is expendable, even generals' lives, in pursuit of victory. If victory required replacements, some of them would have to be expended. One had to be tough. The problem here is that the replacement system was guilty of the worst sin of all in war, inefficiency. It was paying lives, but getting no return. It was just pure waste, and the commanders should have done something about it. Example. In January 1945, Captain Belton Cooper of the 3rd Armored Division got 35 replacements to help crew the 17 new tanks the division had received. These men had just unloaded from the boat in Antwerp a few hours earlier, Cooper said. They had received no previous indoctrination on what they were to do. Not one had any previous experience with tanks. Most of them had never even been in a tank, or even close to one. Cooper gave them a brief verbal orientation. Then his mechanics took small groups into tanks, where each recruit got to fire the main gun 3 times. This was all the training time permitted, Cooper remembered, because the guides came to take the tanks to their assignments to the various units. The previous night, the 35 replacements had been in Antwerp. At 1500, they lumbered off in a convoy of 17 tanks headed for the front. 2 hours later, 15 of the 17 were knocked out by German panzers firing 88s. It often happened that more than half the replacements sent directly into combat became casualties in the first few days. Green divisions put into the front also suffered needless casualties. In December, the 87th Division replaced the 26th Division in the line. So there we sat and shivered in the rain and darkness while contact patrols were sent back to try to lead the relieving company up to us, Lieutenant Ott's of the 26th remembered. Finally, just before midnight, they arrived, fresh and green, and we had been afraid to talk above a whisper for fear of bringing a mortar or 88 barrage in on us. But they came up, talking loudly, wanting to know where their foxholes were, shining flashlights and making quite a racket. Ott's got his platoon, down to 15 men, out of there. On the road leading to the rear, the 26th had only dared to use a single jeep driving at full speed, and then only once a day. Now it was bumper to bumper with 87th Division vehicles. We shrugged it off with a few remarks of, "They'll learn," and forgot about them. Captain Linebaugh remembered a platoon thrown together in the Repel Depple and led by a captain, obviously fresh from the States, that was thrown into the bulge. They were close-shaven, clear-eyed, and wearing clean uniforms. Their bayonets were fixed. To Linebaugh, "They seem totally out of place. An alien caste which had wandered onto the wrong stage." The new captain led his men out to a blocking position on the line, but rather than working through the wood and flanking the objective, he sent the men straight across a field of deep snow toward a fieldstone hut. The Germans let them get in close. When they opened fire, every one of the GIs was killed. We were as mad at the new outfit as we were at the Germans, maybe more so, Linebaugh remembered. We kept calling them dumb bastards. 12 good men were dead. This sort of thing couldn't have happened to us. We knew better. They should have passed on what they knew. The Army should have set up a system to make sure they passed it on. Little things that took only a minute in the telling, like the German practice of firing machine gun tracer ammunition high to coax Americans to maneuver beneath it, then firing low without tracers, or how to distinguish the distinctive smell of German infantry with their sweat-stained leather equipment, or that the easiest way to judge how close to danger you were after riding a deuce and a half to the front was how fast the trucks drove away. The only way to learn about combat is to experience it. But surely the Army could have done more to promote passing on information to replacements and to new divisions, from division staffs down to frontline squads. If a replacement survived the first few days, he had become a combat veteran, but still with a lot to learn. In the good outfits, old-timers took charge. It came down to a hard core of those remaining who hold the unit together, Captain Douglas Smith decided. A core that can accept the replacements, train them, fit them into the squads, even when they had passed their own limits of endurance long ago, and so they are able to carry on until they are gone and the process starts all over again. The 29th Division's saying, "We are three divisions, one in the grave, one in the hospital, one at the front," could be applied to more than 24 U.S. divisions in ETO. And the one at the front consisted of replacements who did not know what to do, and war-weary veterans whose fatalistic attitudes suggested that it did not matter what they did. Fortunately, there was that corps Captain Smith described, who could teach as well as fight. It was critical to the victory, because by the end of the war, men who had been stateside on D-Day made up virtually the whole of the fighting Army. The Army was always learning. After the war, it conducted surveys among the ETO veterans, including detailed material on their training, rightly figuring that it was the combat veterans who could best judge its effectiveness. A majority of the men surveyed had their training in 1944 and fought in the last 6 to 8 months of the war. Perhaps half of them had been through Repel Depples. Every combat veteran I've interviewed, when asked about training, starts with some version of, "Nothing can prepare you for combat." Virtually all the men surveyed agreed. The paratroopers commented that they thought they had been put through a training regime so tough that combat can't be worse than this, only to discover it was. There was a consensus among the GIs that training should be tougher with more live ammunition, and that the best way to prepare a soldier for combat was to improve his stamina and physical strength. The veterans pointed to many additional shortcomings in their training. About 80% said they did not know enough about German weapons, how to defend against them, or how to attack them. They further felt their knowledge of German tactics was deficient. They wished they had been taught more aircraft identification. 90% were unprepared for mine warfare. No one had said to them one word about trench foot, much less how to prevent it. No surprise, they felt all those hours spent doing close order drill and learning military courtesy were wasted. They felt their weapons training had been good, but they had not been taught to follow close behind supporting artillery fire. They tended to slow down on making contact. They allowed German indirect fire to pin them down. Their noise and light discipline at night was poor. They bunched together when fired on. Those that survived the first few days learned how to do better, but they could have been taught at far less cost back in the States. Captain Roland remarks, "The marvel is that the draftee divisions were able to generate and maintain any esprit de corps at all, formed originally by mixing men indiscriminately from throughout the nation, thus severing all personal, social, community, and regional bonds, identified by anonymous numbers and replenished through the notorious REPL DEPLs. Their only source of morale, other than the shared experience of hazard and hardship, was the character and patriotism of the soldiers. Fortunately, that proved to be sufficient." In an article in Army History, published by the U.S. Army's Center of Military History in 1994, Professor Francis Steckel indicts the Army for two reasons. First, the replacement system rushed men into combat without adequate preparation and created an unnecessarily arduous challenge of adjustment on the field of battle. Second, the small number of divisions required units to remain in the front lines without rest and beyond the limits of individual human endurance, thus causing an earlier-than-necessary breakdown of veterans whose invaluable combat experience and skills were lost prematurely. I'd add a third indictment: failure to pass on even rudimentary information. It was not the job of the frontline machine gunner or tanker to train replacements. The Army was supposed to do that, and it failed. Chapter 12. The Air War. Between June 6, 1944, and May 6, 1945, an average of 5,000 American soldiers and airmen per day entered the continent. At the end of 1944, the U.S. Army in the European Theater of Operations numbered 2,700,000 men. Of these, 500,000 were in the Army Air Force. In the ground forces, roughly 300,000 were frontline infantry, with another 300,000 or so in the artillery, armor, or other combat support roles. Of the Air Force personnel, about half were ground crews and administrative types. The other half, some quarter of a million young Americans, were pilots or air crew in the 8th and 9th Air Forces. They saw plenty of combat, but their living conditions were far better than those on the front lines. Airmen had beds, clean sheets, hot food, showers, clean clothes. They had some privacy, if only a footlocker in the bunkhouse. They had regular and easy access to a London in which a pack of cigarettes would pay for a woman and a night's worth of booze. They got medals and promotions faster than the ground soldiers. They were the envy of the men in the foxholes. But there were moments when airmen envied the infantry. For the crews on the bombers, there was no choice about whether to enter a raging battle, or stay put and out of it, or run away. Willy-nilly, the bomber crews went in when the plane did. On a B-17 or a B-24, the pilot took, rather than led, his 9 crew members into an apparently solid wall of exploding 88-millimeter shells. The men could not move around, hide, duck, run away. The gunners could shoot, but only if a German fighter came at the bomber from the right angle. For those not shooting, flying through flak was an experience similar to an infantryman's getting caught in the open in a shelling. Men were helpless and terrified. One difference in the combat experience of ground and air warriors was in depth of perception. In interviews, infantry veterans emphasized that their war was 20 meters to the left and 20 meters to the right. Beyond that, they saw little and knew less. Seldom did a foot soldier get to see more than a tiny bit of the U.S. Army in Europe. Airmen saw the war on a continent-wide scale. They were on one of thousands of planes, spread as far as one could see. It frequently happens that infantrymen, asked in an interview what they remember most vividly about the war, will recall a specific incident, while an airman will generalize, as did Lieutenant Marvin Kraft, a navigator in the 8th Air Force. What struck me most was the scope, scale, and intensity of the war. Looking back, it seems we were on some kind of giant assembly line. We moved to a grand design. Kraft was part of an assembly line, one that reached from Willow Run, where the B-24s were made at the Ford plant, to Berlin, where bombs made in a munitions plant in Mississippi were dropped. And he was part of a grand design to destroy Germany's ability to make and move weapons. To that end, the United States invested a considerable portion of her total effort in the bombing campaign. At the pinnacle of the effort were the 4-engine bombers in the 8th Air Force. It is best described by oral historian Gerald Astor in his 1997 book, The Mighty 8th, The Air War in Europe, as told by the men who fought it. In all likelihood, the world will never see another organization like the Mighty 8th, which at its zenith nearly blotted out the sky with aircraft. Astor goes on to note, like all great enterprises, particularly when operating under the demands of war, it was hardly a smoothly running machine. The frustration inherent in the air war was very high. The infantry could measure progress by numbers of enemy killed or taken prisoner, and by ground gained. But the airmen seldom saw an enemy fall, never took a prisoner. Far from winning, they seemed in the late fall of 1944 to be in danger of losing, as the Luftwaffe proved exceedingly difficult to kill off. In the summer and fall of 1944, the bombers had gone deep into Germany to strike oil, transportation, and industrial targets. Often there were no German fighters to contest the skies. But by late fall, in time for the Ardennes counteroffensive, the Luftwaffe had made a comeback. It was able to put planes in the air for night bombardment of Bastogne and other towns when conditions permitted. On Christmas Eve, the Germans mounted their biggest aerial effort of the entire campaign in northwest Europe. On New Year's Day, some 600 German planes hit British airfields at Eindhoven and Brussels, destroying 180 or more parked planes. This was discouraging in the extreme. For nearly half a year, the Americans had been going after the Luftwaffe's fuel supplies and the factories where the planes were being made. And now, there were more enemy planes in the skies than there had been 6 months earlier. The Germans had dispersed aircraft production from 27 main plants to 729 small ones. The number of single-engine fighters reaching the Luftwaffe rose from 1,016 built in February 1944 to 3,013 in September. Overall, German armament production rose in November 1944 to 260% above the beginning of 1942. Still, as a result of the oil campaign, the new planes were rather like the new tanks that went into the Bulge. Great weapons, but what was the use of them when there was no fuel? And the German pilots entering the battle in late 1944 had insufficient training time to become competent. In most cases, no more than an hour or two in the air a week. For the Allies, the big worry in late 1944 about the air war was Germany's jet aircraft production. The ME-163 single-engine and ME-262 twin-engine fighters had already been built by the hundreds. The Arado 234 jet bomber was just coming into production. They were capable of 550 miles per hour, about 100 miles per hour faster than the P-51s and P-47s. Not until October 1945 did the Americans expect to have a jet airplane, and in the event, 2 years after the end of the war, the ME-262 being flown at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, was still judged superior to the new USAF P-80 jet fighter. Going into the year 1945, some Allied airmen feared that if the war lasted until June, the jets might yet restore control of German skies to the Luftwaffe. As early as September, General Karl Spatz, commanding the 8th Air Force, had given jet production priority among his targets, second only to oil. On January 9, 1945, he gave jets first priority. Still, they came on. In the air, as on the ground, the Germans had demonstrated a resourcefulness and determination that, in the wake of the pounding they had taken, invited the use of the word miracle. The air crews of the American bombers, meanwhile, discovered they had to fly more missions. First it was 25, then it was raised to 35. It kept climbing as high as 70 in a few cases. There were volunteers who completed 100 missions. Occasionally, the missions were so-called milk runs, with no fighter opposition and no flak. More often, there would be one or the other. Much too often, they faced both fighters and flak. In 1943, before the P-51 provided long-range fighter escort over Germany, only 35% of the 8th Air Force crews survived 25 missions. The figure rose to 66% after the P-51 came along in 1944.
This ends Disc 10.